We are back on the record. The next attorney will be Mr. Miller, who is the attorney for the City of Federal Way. How much time would you like, Mr. Miller?
5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
You bet. Go ahead.
Thank you. As you mentioned, I represent the City of Federal Way, which is an intervener in this matter. We filed a joint petition, one with the cities of Kent, Auburn, and King County Sheriff's Office, asking for writs of prohibition, declaratory relief, and injunctive relief to issue. As a preliminary matter, I want to make clear that the City of Federal Way supports government transparency and believes that police accountability is as important now than it ever was. This action is not brought to avoid inquests in any way. It's brought to ensure that the inquests that go forward in this county are conducted fairly and within the bounds of the law. The City of Federal Way and its police department have participated in inquests since the department was formed in the late 90s, and its officers, as other counsel have noted, have voluntarily agreed to come in and testify during these proceedings. The problem now is that the executive's current inquest rules under the executive order have converted the inquest process from one that is a fact-finding mission to one that is a fault-finding mission that has all of the hallmarks of civil litigation or even criminal litigation in some respects. That exceeds the power that was granted to the executive under the Coroner's Act and under the King County ordinance through which he is acting. Now, Mr. Epps has touched on a number of subjects, and I'm going to discuss more of the practicalities as they apply to expert witnesses and evidence on training and compliance with policy and the problems that are associated with those and how they've really converted this in the simple fact-finding inquest process into civil proceedings that are best left in other courts. First, with respect to expert witnesses, should any part of the executive's order remain and an inquest be allowed to go forward under the order, the court should declare that the executive order only allows for factual experts to testify. It does not allow for hired outside experts to come in and render basically evidence rule 702 opinion testimony on the propriety of officer actions or city policies and training with respect to the officers. And the basis for this request is in the executive order itself, appendix 2, section 12.1. It reads, each party, including the administrator, may proffer its own witnesses to provide testimony that aids the panel in the understanding of the facts, including factual areas of experts, example, ballistics and forensic medical examination. And that is historically exactly how inquests have been conducted. The medical examiner will cut up and testify about the bullet wounds and investigators who were on the scene on the evening or day after the shooting will testify about bullet trajectories, gunpowder remnant tracings, things that help establish the facts of how the use of deadly force happened, where the parties were positioned, things that all go to facts. That statute speaks in that terms, and it only allows for those factual experts who were involved in the underlying investigation of the deadly force incident. It does not allow for the parties to hire expert witnesses to come in and advocate or render opinion testimony on what happened. Hired experts had no involvement in the underlying investigation, and they come in, and as this court knows, in civil litigation and in criminal litigation, they'll review the materials, they'll review photos, they'll review officer testimony, they'll review officer statements, they'll review whatever materials are available to be reviewed, and then they will render opinion about what should or shouldn't have been done or what is or is not proper. And the inquest proceeding is not forum for that type of testimony. It doesn't allow for hired outside experts to come in that regard, and that's in keeping with the Coroner's Act. Carrick v. Locke is directly on point in this respect. In that case, at page 133, the court, the Supreme Court stated a coroner's inquest is not a culpability finding proceeding. And as the county pointed out in their brief at page 8, also citing Carrick, an inquest is an investigative inquiry where the jury is asked to determine who died, what was the cause of the death, and what were the circumstances surrounding the death. What we have now is something that is growing into a behemoth that has gone so far beyond those simple inquiries that it is turning into a second civil, well, it'll be the first civil trial, and probably, you know, the actual civil trial follows suit after that. And that's not proper, and that's not how the Coroner's Act conveys authority. The evidence presented in the inquest must be relevant to those factual questions and those factual questions only. Questions about liability have always been, you know, objections to questions about liability have always been sustained by those presiding over inquests. And they're never appropriate in this fact-finding forum that is an inquest proceeding. In the Gust inquest, Administrator Spearman allowed for parties to call police practices experts who are typically used in civil litigation to explain whether what the officer did was consistent with national standards or police practices, however they want to frame the issue, but it goes to fault. It goes to this officer did something wrong or this officer did this correctly. And that is beyond scope of RCW 36.24, which only seeks the facts of the incident. Further, the executive's order on November 19th of 2019 in the Lyles matter also talks about that, and as we cited in our brief, discussed Civil Rule 26B5A1, which is a discovery rule in civil litigation that pertains to experts and disclosure of their opinions. By its nature, we're talking about opinion testimony from hired outside experts that is simply beyond the scope of the inquest proceeding as set forth in the coroner statute. The other issue with that is when we get into the requirement that the chief of the agency of the officers involved come in and testify about the policies and training that the officers were acting under, that too is not part of the coroner's statute's mandate. There's no provision for that in the statute. The executive act has acted beyond his authority by creating this new avenue of inquiry and putting questions to the jury about whether the officers acted in compliance with training policy. As I believe it was Mr. Burial mentioned, that's an opinion finding. That is not a factual finding. That's asking lay jurors who have no knowledge of a policies of a department's policies to render their own opinions as to whether the officer complied with those policies and training with very little information, having just heard testimony for a couple of days in some instances. Again, this exceeds the authority granted to the executive under the Coroner's Act. There's nothing in Ordinance 2.35A090B that expands the nature of the inquest to anything other than a determination of the cause and circumstances of the death. The executive cannot create new law in this regard, and that is what he's done. If the bigger problem with allowing the jury to render findings on whether an officer was in or out of compliance with a department's policies and training is that the new Initiative 940 under that vehicle, the criminal statute, which is 9A36, hang on, I gotta find it. 9A16040 now contemplates whether the officer was acting in compliance with his or her policies and training at the time that they acted in terms of finding criminal culpability. So if an officer is dragged into court and forced to testify, but not allowed to test and is asked questions about custom policy, that is actually implicating his Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination under the criminal statutes. The that ties in with the other piece of our brief, which was the right to be represented by counsel has been kind of shifted back and forth, I guess, for lack of a better term, by the executive, as noted by other counsel, where an officer's right to be represented in the proceeding, and it's only this only applies to the officers. It doesn't apply to any other party in the inquest proceeding under the executive's order. He conditioned it on a waiver of a Fifth Amendment right. The officer can only participate through counsel if he or she agrees to come in and testify. Now, on June 11th, in response to the petitions that have been filed in this matter, he issued a new order that did away with that requirement. And what we would ask is that the court should enter an order enjoining him from changing his mind again, and re-implementing that provision into any inquest proceedings in the future. It is simply unconstitutional to condition a Fifth Amendment or a Sixth Amendment right in some way, especially when the one entity, the one party that stands to face criminal liability in the future is the law enforcement officer who's testifying about the use of deadly force. Similarly, this wasn't part of our petition in particular, but it's come up, and it goes to the unfairness, the appearance of unfairness, which is the disciplinary records being introduced into evidence if the administrator somehow determines that they are, quote, directly related to the use of force, which is the language in the order. Again, this just highlights how we're skewing towards civil litigation. And even in a federal civil rights suit where there's a Fourth Amendment claim for excessive force, courts rarely, if ever, let in that type of propensity evidence. And by that, I mean, you know, under Rule 404B, parties can't introduce past bad acts to show that the person acted badly in this instance. So how a disciplinary proceeding against an officer bears on what that officer did during the use of deadly force is, there's no link. The only basis for bringing that evidence in would be to somehow show that the officer had done other things in the past and was now doing those same things again. You know, in the classic legalese sense, has the propensity to continue committing bad acts, and that's what they did here, as Your Honor knows. So, again, this is another area where the executive has overstepped his bounds under the Coroner's Act and is now opening up the inquest process into one that is an adversarial litigation proceeding, not a fact-finding mission. As to the family's request that the court command that inquests include questions about criminal liability, there are so many problems with that request because of constitutional issues. The burden of proof in an inquest is probability. It's more probable than not. It's not guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There are no procedural protections in an inquest proceeding that exist in a criminal proceeding. Counsel for the accused, as it were, can't advocate in an inquest proceeding. So counsel for the police cannot get up and give opening statement or closing argument. There's a stare decisis issue, which is that in Carrick v. Locke, the court unequivocally held that a coroner's inquest is not a culpability finding or not a culpability finding proceeding, and yet that is what the family's asked it to turn into. And beyond that, they want it to be a criminal culpability proceeding. So, Your Honor, we would ask that you grant our petition and enter the relief that we've requested. I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, you have 7 minutes remaining. I know you had requested 5, but you have 7.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Filer, who's appearing as the attorney on behalf of the inquest administrator, retired Judge Michael Spearman. Mr. Filer?
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to be heard this morning. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may, for a rebuttal.
Sure. Go ahead.
in addition to myself and my colleague, Ms. Galina, who are with us this morning, I'd like to note and acknowledge that Administrator Spearman and Administrator Terrence Carroll are both also on the call with us to hear these proceedings this morning.
I'm aware because I'm the one who's admitting everybody into this, so I'm aware that Judge Spearman was here earlier and Judge Carroll just arrived a few minutes ago.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to avoid covering ground that's already been plowed, but there are a few issues that are of particular interest to the administrators that I'd like to focus some attention on. And the first one, and the most important one, and the one that if you don't take anything away from what I say this morning, is this. The inquest proceedings over which the administrators have been appointed to preside have to get back underway as soon as possible.
But you understand, Mr. Filer, I hate to interrupt. Whatever I do, it's going to be appealed.
We can all speculate about how that might come to pass, but my point here is that the administrators feel very strongly
sure
that these are issues that are important for a whole host of reasons. And the principal reason is that everyone who is affected by the incidents that are at issue here, whether it's the family of the deceased, or it's the involved officers, or the agencies that employ them, and probably most importantly, the public, all benefit from the objective and transparent fact-finding that goes on in these proceedings. And the proceedings that you've heard about this morning, candidly, they all involve deaths that took place in 2017. Since that time, there's a backlog of additional incidents that have been identified as appropriate for conducting inquest proceedings. And we just think it's really important and want to emphasize to the court that this is a process that needs to get back underway just as soon as it possibly can. So that's my main pitch for you this morning. I do want to comment on one other preliminary point that came up in the reply briefs that were filed by the officers and the cities and the sheriff. And it's the question of whether it was proper for the administrator to provide views on the claims that have been asserted in these proceedings. And they cite the Code of Judicial Conduct without any other authority for the proposition that it wasn't appropriate for them to take positions. I think that betrays an ongoing confusion about what these proceedings really are. Inquests are not judicial trials. The administrators are not acting as judges in these cases. They are acting under the delegated authority from the executive branch and not as judicial officers. So the Judicial Conduct Code simply doesn't apply. Second, they all sued the administrator, albeit in his official capacity, seeking, in some cases, to require that certain things take place during the course of these inquest proceedings, and in other instances, to prohibit things from taking place in those proceedings. And I just don't think they could reasonably have expected that the administrator would sit on the sidelines and remain silent and not provide his or her perspective on those issues. And third, to the extent anybody is asserting that they were surprised or somehow prejudiced by the administrator taking a public position, as Mr. Estes called it, on these points, there's no surprise there. All of these parties were involved in and briefed and argued these issues before those rulings got made. And what the administrator was really trying to do with his separate brief and the other positions that we've taken is to just provide the court with the perspective of the officer who has been charged with overseeing these important and very sensitive proceedings. So that's all I really have to say on that point. I want to talk about the appearance of fairness, because there are a couple of things that have not been said that need to be heard. Our principal point on this is that the model of having an executive branch employee preside over these proceedings simply does not implicate the appearance of fairness doctrine. And just to give you a little bit of context here, as the court knows from reading the papers, the inquest review committee that was formed when the executive started to figure out how he wanted to reform the inquest process, that work started in late 2017. But in early 2018, there was an additional curveball that got thrown to the executive. Because at that time, the chief judge of the King County District Court advised the executive that after decades of presiding over these proceedings, the district court judges were not going to take any more assignments of that nature. And we've all talked to you a lot about Carrick v. Locke, but one of the things that we know from Carrick v. Locke is that under the separation of powers doctrine, the executive cannot force the district court judges to take on that assignment. He can ask them, they can voluntarily take it on, but he can't force them to do it. And so it left the executive with a need to find alternative presiding officers for the inquest proceedings. And there were some suggestions that came out of the inquest review committee. But ultimately, as you've seen from the declarations that Administrator Spearman and Administrator Carroll and Administrator McBeth submitted, what he landed on was just about the very best alternative you could have come up with. Retired judges with decades of experience in both civil and criminal cases, overseeing high-profile cases with sensitive issues and difficult evidentiary rulings that were going to have to get made. If you were going to craft the perfect person to oversee these kinds of proceedings, that's what you'd be looking for. And that's what the executive did. And I think you'll hear a little bit more from Ms. Hanner about the scope of the executive's authority to make policy in this area. But that was a policy choice that he made. And frankly, it's not one that's subject to review by writs of either mandamus or prohibition. And we've explained in the executive's brief why we think that there are decades of case law making it clear that the appearance of fairness doctrine doesn't apply to investigative proceedings of the nature that are the inquiry here. But I want to talk for just a second about a section of Carrick v. Locke that gets cited a lot here for the idea that somehow the appearance of fairness doctrine is a basis upon which this court could invalidate the process. And to be clear, it just doesn't. Because what happened in Carrick v. Locke was the court talked about a hypothetical situation that didn't exist in that case and doesn't exist in this case. What the court said, after talking about the delegation powers of the executive, was that the public's perception of impartiality in an inquest was vitally important. And then they went on to observe that if the executive was ultimately responsible both for the conduct of the officer that was presiding over the hearing and the law enforcement officer whose conduct was being reviewed, that that might not be perceived as being impartial or unfair, or fair. We know that's not what happened in Carrick v. Locke because there was a district court judge that presided over that proceeding. And we know that's not what is happening under this current executive order, because we have an executive officer that's been delegated the authority by the executive for whose conduct the executive is still responsible. But the officer's conduct is not something that the executive is responsible for anymore. We have a separately elected sheriff who oversees the conduct of sheriff's officers, and it has certainly never been the case that the county executive would have been responsible for the conduct of officers that are employed by other law enforcement agencies. So to the extent the briefs, and there are multiple references to this piece of Carrick in the briefs, the extent there is some hint in there that that's the appearance of unfairness that ought to set this process aside, the court should disregard that.
I'm going to ask one quick question. So I believe Mr. Estes' brief indicated, and there was an exhibit, that the paycheck comes from the county, including the contract of hiring the administrators. And it happened to be Judge Spearman, my former colleague. And it shows that he's an at-will employee. So where's the separation?
Well, the separation is the important one that Jarrett B. Locke talked about. The issue there was whether having the executive be responsible for both sets of conduct was what gave rise to some kind of improper bias.
I'm not asking about both. I'm just asking about the administrators that have been hand-selected by the executive.
Well, Your Honor, the administrators that have been appointed here and the district court judges that were previously presiding over this were in the same position. They were both being appointed by the executive to exercise the executive's power under the coroner statute to do the fact-finding that's necessary under the coroner statute. So I really don't think that that's a meaningful distinction. And if you took it all the way to the logical extreme, there was some possibility that the executive could have withdrawn the appointment of the district court judge in the course of a coroner's inquest. I don't think we've ever seen that here. And there is certainly not any indication. As a matter of fact, one of the counsel went so far as to say, we know that these administrators will have the ability to exercise impartial judgment in the course of these proceedings. So we can speculate perhaps about what might happen in the future, but I don't think you've got that issue in front of you right now.
Okay. You still have two more minutes if you want to reserve five.
Thank you, Your Honor. I also want to address in my remaining time this question of whether the administrator has discretion to decide what is going to be heard by way of testimony and witnesses at the inquest proceeding. And the petitioners have, in various flavors, contended that all of the witnesses have to be compelled to testify. The officers have complained that Ms. Butts was excluded from testifying. But what we need to do is start with the statute. What the statute says is that once the inquest is called for, and this is RCW 3624050, it says the coroner must summon and examine every person who, in his or her opinion, or in the opinion of any of the jury, has knowledge of facts. And so that's plain language in and of itself, invests the coroner, or in this case the administrator, with the discretion to make a decision about whether someone has knowledge of the facts that ought to be heard at the inquest. And for all of its faults, Jarrett B. Locke does answer this one question. It's in language that really can't be second-guessed, that this statutory language leaves it to the coroner, or the administrator here, and the inquest jury to decide what evidence is going to be heard. And I'll quote now, it is for the judge and the jury alone to decide what matters must be properly inquired into in order to fulfill their statutory duty. That's Jarrett B. Locke at 125 Washington 2nd, page 144, footnote 9. All the executive order does is implement that direction from the statute and from the Supreme Court by investing the administrators with discretion to make decisions about admissible evidence pursuant to evidence rules and other rules that are laid out in the executive order. So there isn't any question that the executive's delegee has the discretion to decide what evidence is going to come in pursuant to their statutory rules. And with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, it's about 4.5 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Feiler.
Thank you, Ryan.
Okay. The last party will be the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, who's representing King County Executive Dow Constantine. So is it going to be Mr. Cuffell or Ms. Canner?
I'm me, Your Honor. Samantha Canner for the record on behalf of the King County Executive Dow Constantine being sued in his official capacity.
How much time?
Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. In King County, inquests are an important fact-finding tool for public transparency for law enforcement-involved deaths. They provide the public with an opportunity to understand what led to the officer's use of force against a member of the public, what the surrounding circumstances of that use of force was, what force was used and by whom, and how the use of force either caused or contributed to the death of the decedent. An inquest is not a culpability proceeding for either civil or criminal liability. Such liability can only be determined by a judge or a jury in a judicial proceeding. It is exactly because an inquest does not determine liability and its non-binding nature that makes many of the issues raised in the various petitions filed here unreviewable by this court. For example, because the inquest does not determine rights, responsibilities, or the liability of its participants, and because the participants cannot suffer direct harm from the inquest, none of the parties here have standing to challenge either the executive order or the rulings of the administrator. For these same reasons, no participant has a right to demand participation in the inquest by a counsel. The inquest does not trigger a Fifth or Sixth Amendment right to counsel because the individual is neither in custody as a result of the inquest, and they're not in legal jeopardy as a result of the inquest. For these same reasons, the appearance of fairness doctrine, which is a due process right, does not apply to inquests. The non-binding nature of this process makes sense because the inquest procedures are a result of executive policymaking. Review of such discretionary policymaking would constitute a violation of separation of powers because it would involve the judicial branch dictating to the executive branch how to perform executive branch powers. I want to primarily discuss two issues before the court, namely standing and the appearance of fairness doctrine. And I'm going to obviously rest on my briefing on a lot of other issues since I have limited time here. But before I do that, I want to clarify to the court where the executive gets the power to hold an inquest, because municipal petitioners repeatedly misstate this issue in their briefing and in oral arguments here today. RCW Chapter 3624 is the vehicle by which the state legislature created the Office of the County Coroner and conferred upon the county coroner the power to conduct inquests. Those powers are contained throughout Chapter 3624. Now, there are additional coroner powers and duties contained in Chapter 6850 that are given to the coroner, or in counties that are over 250,000 people and have chosen to have a medical examiner, those powers go to the medical examiner. And the title of that chapter is called Human Remains, but is colloquially referred to as the Medical Examiner Statute and deals with autopsies, disposal of human remains, death certificates, et cetera. Now, the King County Charter, which is not a document merely adopted by ordinance by the King County Council, but rather a charter adopted by the people of King County as a home rule charter county, lays out the powers of the executive in Section 320. And this section is one that is completely ignored in municipal petitioner's briefing. Specifically, in 3-2020, the King County Executive is given, quote, all the executive powers of the county which are not expressly vested in other specific elective officers by this charter, end quote. The executive is further given the power of being the chief peace officer of the county, who shall execute and enforce all ordinances and state statutes within the county. That same section also provides the executive the power to assign his duties to administrative officers and executive departments that are not specifically assigned by this charter or ordinance, meaning he can create departments beneath him even if they were not contemplated by the county legislature. And it also includes that those specific executive powers enumerated in Section 3-2020 should not be construed as limiting the powers of the county executive. So, municipal petitioners want to have this court find that some ordinance gives the county executive the coroner's powers, but that simply is not correct. The charter itself in Section 3-2020 is what gives the executive the coroner's powers. And then Charter Section 895, which is titled Mandatory Inquest, does not reference who conducts inquests, but merely states an inquest shall be held to investigate the causes and circumstances of any death involving a member of the law enforcement agency of the county in the performance of the member's duties. That section does not delineate all circumstances under which an inquest may be held in King County. Rather, it merely mandates that inquests shall be held when a death involves law enforcement in King County. And it's important to understand how that provision operates in order to understand what the true nature of the executive power is. Instead, municipal petitioners point you to King County Code Provision 235A090B and C, which creates the King County Medical Examiner. The King County Medical Examiner was not established by charter. Rather, it's established by the King County Legislature in response to a code provision 3624-190 in the coroner statute that allows for larger counties in the state of Washington to establish a medical examiner. Those two provisions both specifically refer to the coroner's powers under Chapter 6850 of the RCWs, and actually don't reference at all Chapter 3624, because the majority of Chapter 3624 is inquest powers. Instead, that chapter, that ordinance specifies that the medical examiner has a number of coroner's powers, but that the inquest power remains with the King County Executive. So that ordinance does not confer power on the executive. It confers powers onto the medical examiner and confirms that the executive maintains the executive powers of the coroner. Now, the two primary issues that I want to move on to address, as I said, are standing and the appearance of fairness. First, with regard to standing, none of the petitioners here have standing to challenge the executive order. And I want to be clear that this includes the families, the municipalities, and the involved officers themselves, because the municipal petitioners in their reply brief make this argument about representational standing, and I think that's a red herring. Now, any party would have standing, as happened in the BNSF case, to contest a subpoena, which is legal process against them. So a subpoena uses TICUM or a subpoena for a deposition, the parties would have standing to challenge if a subpoena was sought against them or a subpoena was issued against them. However, none of them have that here. No subpoenas have yet been issued, either pre-inquest or for the inquest hearing, and thus no party has standing, and if they did, they would be limited to standing with regard to contesting that subpoena, not the entirety of the inquest process, the executive order itself. City petitioners additionally claim that because Carrick addressed inquest, that of course they have standing. The problem with that is nobody in Carrick raised the issue of standing. So the Washington State Supreme Court has not spoken on this issue whatsoever. It means nothing that the respondents in that case didn't raise the issue of standing, so the court didn't address it. And there aren't any Washington cases directly addressing the issue of standing with regard to inquest, because it apparently hasn't been raised before. Now, in their reply brief, the Lyle family incorrectly asserts that the court addressed standing with regard to inquest powers in Thompson versus Wilson, but that's not correct. In Thompson versus Wilson, the mother of a decedent in that case was not challenging the inquest process under RCW 3624. Rather, she sought mandamus because the coroner in that case was depriving her of a specific right that had been given to her under a separate state statute, under RCW 6850-105. Now that statute, a part of the Human Remains Chapter, expressly gave the family of the decedent a right to meet with the coroner and to review findings with the coroner. And the mother had a statutory right to that and alleged that the coroner was not complying with that statutory right, and that's what she had standing. Conversely, the coroner statute provides no rights to anyone other than the coroner and the jury. Theoretically, the executive could convene an inquest, either with an executive order or without an executive order, and hold a hearing without the participation of anyone, other than obviously calling witnesses and having a jury seated there. Now, some of the parties before you today might be called as witnesses in that hearing, and then would have standing again to contest any subpoenas issued to them, but they would have no participatory rights because the coroner statute does not contemplate any participation. The coroner statute rather provides a shell of a framework, and Carrick tells us that the executive is free to fill in the gap in that shell. Additionally, the petitioners inadequately addressed the Nader case that I cite out of Pennsylvania, which explains that the family members have the same interest as the public, the mere interest in a fair hearing, because their rights are not adjudicated in an inquest. And the inquiry in that case focused on the potential harm that was alleged by the father of the decedent in that case, who claimed emotional anguish and reputational harm based on the stigma of a finding of suicide, a pre-inquest finding of suicide. And he was seeking to force the inquest to occur because he wanted a hearing essentially to show that his son had not committed suicide. Now, the same rationale here applies to both the officers and the family. Because their rights are not adjudicated in an inquest, they lack standing. Here, presumably, the families want the finding that their loved one was wrongfully killed, and presumably the officers and the municipalities conversely want finding that the killing was justified by the situation or the actions of the decedent. So similar to the finding sought by the father and Nader, petitioners want a finding consistent with their reputational interests because they understand that the results are not binding on future legal proceedings. There is no collateral estoppel for a civil hearing or for a criminal hearing. Now, our briefing further cites two Nevada cases, and I've conceded in my briefing specifically that those are due process cases. They didn't address standing, but the same rationale applies on standing as does to the due process right, because it focuses the inquiry on whether or not there is potential injury to the participant. And in that case, it was the officers were contesting portions of the inquest process. And both the state and federal courts in Nevada explained that the officers were not entitled to due process, the type of process that they would receive in a criminal or a civil hearing, because of the lack of adjudication of their rights, and explained that any reputational harm is too attenuated, that the officers would receive protection from any kind of future bias, from essentially tainting of the jury pool, through that due process afforded to them in that civil or criminal proceeding. They would have the right to exclude those jurors through one year.
Excuse me, Ms. Cantor, does somebody have a dog in the background?
It's me, Your Honor.
No. It's okay. If it's you, it's fine. I just want to make sure it's not somebody else. Go ahead.
I can deal with it. I do have earbuds in for that purpose, but unfortunately, dogs do what they want to do.
Yeah, I got it. Not a problem.
Thank you. So moving on to the appearance of fairness issue, I want to address two arguments made by the city specifically in their reply brief on the issue of appearance of fairness. And I'm not going to repeat everything Mr. Filer said. I'm seeking to supplement what he said. First, in raising the issue of appearance of fairness, municipal petitioners failed to address the four-part test required by the state Supreme Court in determining that an administrative hearing is judicial or quasi-judicial. And that test is set out in Raines versus Leavenworth, 118, 12nd, 237. It's a 1992 case. And the important element that's missing here is whether or not the tribunal is convened for the purpose of declaring or enforcing liability. And that's what's not present here, right? This is not a binding, the inquest is not a binding hearing. It doesn't adjudicate rights. Thus, it cannot be quasi-judicial. Now, RCW 4236 codified that doctrine for land use hearings and also contains that same provision. So rather than addressing this insurmountable issue, they focus on the trappings of the hearing, that it involves sworn testimony, that it's formalized, i.e. that it looks a lot like a court hearing. And even the executive calls it quasi-judicial in his executive order, so it must be quasi-judicial. The problem with that is it forgets the issue, the most important issue, that this hearing does not adjudicate rights. Now, there are many examples of administrative hearings that require the application of the appearance of fairness doctrine, annexation procedures, disciplinary hearings. In Ray Peterson was a disciplinary hearing case, land use and zoning boards, permitting boards, the Lutheran Daycare Center involved permitting, etc. But they all have in common the results of such hearings or decisions being binding on their participants. Instead, an inquest is more akin to a probation officer's pre-sentence investigation, or an employment investigation, or even a law enforcement investigation, some of which may lead to consequences down the road, but are not in and of themselves binding on the participant. The second thing I want to address is the quotation of N. Ray Peterson, which we cite in our brief, where the Washington Supreme Court cites to its own opinion in Harris for support of the proposition that the doctrine does not apply to coroner's inquests. The city would like you to believe that that citation is about the prosecutor's role in an inquest and point the court to page 143, footnote 8 of the Harris opinion that's specifically about the prosecutor's role. The problem with that argument is twofold. First, that's not what the Supreme Court said. I want to quote from the Supreme Court, and they said, the doctrine does not apply to executive functions such as prosecutorial inquests or coroner's inquests. And then it cites to Finch and to Carrick. That language is binding precedent on this court, and it's a plain statement that the appearance of fairness doctrine does not apply to inquest. It does not say anything about the prosecutor's role in inquest. The second problem with the city's argument is that they point you to page 143, footnote 8, but that's not what the citation points to. The citation points to pages 140 to 143. If the court was talking about the prosecutor's role, why did they not point to the footnote or just to page 143? Why did they instead point to the entire section on the delegation of the executive's duty to perform coroner inquests?
You have about 3 minutes left of your entire 20, just to let you know.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you. Thus, despite the confusion caused by the dicta and Carrick, the citation is that the Supreme Court unequivocally stated that it would not need to review the delegation of coroner's powers through the lens of the appearance of fairness doctrine. So they said the delegation to a district court judge was legally permissible, but not legally required. And as Mr. Feiler said in his statement, they did not address the situation that is present here. Instead, they addressed a hypothetical situation that was not present there, and that's why it did. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we ask this court to deny the writ of prohibition, mandamus, review, and declaratory judgment, and I'll reserve the rest of my time.
It's about 2.5 minutes, counsel.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to go back. We have concluded the opening and most of the arguments by all counsel. Ms. Baker, you have about 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. First, I want to address the county's argument that the family does not stand, and their argument that the families want a particular outcome. The families don't want a particular outcome. We want a thorough investigation of the deadly use of force, and we have the standing to challenge inquest procedures that run counter the statutory requirements for inquest. Unlike the case in Nader that the county relies very heavily upon, the families are not seeking or requesting that an inquest occur. These inquests have been called, and the county has specifically made the families a party to the inquest. Our interest is radically different than the community's interest. We are not vindicating the emotional harm that the use of deadly force has caused the families. We are seeking to ensure that the inquest process is thorough and it actually complies with state law. And unlike the family in Nader, we have the standing to do that because we are parties to this and because we're challenging an injury that has been caused by the process and procedures of the inquest itself. I also want to address the statement by counsel for the officers who killed Damaris Butts. One, there was a statement that Damaris Butts discharged his firearm first at the officers, and that is a fundamental fact that we don't actually know at this point. There was a civilian witness who was next to Officer Kennedy who has not been questioned, has not had the opportunity to take the stand and let the public know exactly what they saw. And until that occurs, we just don't know what happened, which is why we need to make sure that this process is thorough and fair so that officers are not able to simply assert their version of the truth. When it comes to the officer's Fifth Amendment argument, here, if the court accepts their argument, you would be creating an entirely new line of constitutional protection that only apply to law enforcement. Law officers, just like every other individual, if they are called to testify in a non-criminal matter, if there is a question that is asked of them that they feel like an answer might incriminate themselves, they have the ability, the authority, and the right to not answer that question, to assert the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination for that particular question. What they don't have is the right to just simply say, we'll never take the stand, we'll never answer any question, because potentially some question that theoretically could be asked might implicate a Fifth Amendment protection. And, ideally we live in a world where our law enforcement officers are not so afraid of the actions that they have taken in our name that every single last one of them is concerned that if they answer a single question in an inquest, that will result in self-incrimination. The law is really clear. The Fifth Amendment privilege that permits a person to refuse to testify at a criminal trial or refuse to answer official questions asked in any other proceeding where the answer might tend to incriminate him or her in future criminal proceedings is not a blanket protection in these civil proceedings. That individual can invoke that right for each question that is asked that might actually have an answer that would be self-incriminating. And then further, I want to say law enforcement officers really have, you know, raised a whole host of issues and concerns about the inquest process. But primarily what it comes down to is their disagreement with the inquest process. You know, I think one of the counsel said, you know, it's not like the good old days. Or, you know, a concern that the inquest will go on for more than 2 days as the parties really drill down and look at the facts and the causes of death.
You have about 30 seconds. I hate to do it.
Sorry, what was that?
You have about 30 seconds.
And then I also want to say that there is statutory authority for pre-inquest hearing discovery. RCW 36-24-200, the legislature clarified and affirmed the grant of authority for the ability to subpoena documents and witnesses before an inquest hearing. And there has been no argument put forward by law enforcement that undercuts the plain language of that statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Ms. Parker, you have just about 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I want to remind you, no one gets punished as a result of this inquest. Nothing happens. There's no fine. There's no penalty. Counsel for the officers conflates a criminal proceeding with the inquest, and it simply is not that. It is an investigatory proceeding. And counsel also for the officer called it a political proceeding, which I think is indicative of the police department's state of mind. It is an investigation with more structure in order to determine what happened and ultimately if what happened was a crime. When they also conflated the criminal process, the criminal legal process, indicating that because the executive order excludes the mention of state of mind and portions of it, that therefore wouldn't be able to assert any sort of mental defense. The reality is, of course, if there was going to be a question of criminal means, the available defenses would be to the panel, the jury. Of course they would. Of course that would be something that is available because they would be instructed on the law. The other theme I heard throughout counsel for the officer's presentation is that somehow juries aren't sophisticated enough to understand training, to understand use of force, to understand issues that that the officers are somewhat complex. Your Honor, juries are trusted with the most complex questions in our country. That is the bedrock and the foundation of what we believe. They do asbestos trials. They do complex harm civil cases. They do medical malpractice where they, you know, have to learn all sorts of science and understand it and digest it. To say that police officer practices are somehow too complex for the common person, the juror, is absurd, and it contravenes everything we stand for. So that was a common theme that I wanted to address. Moreover, it brings me, experts are important and why experts are necessary. Yes, there may be some complex concepts. They may be in the form of ballistics or crime scene reconstruction, or maybe training. And it's up to the administrator to listen to what those experts have to say and decide if it's necessary for the jury to understand and digest the issues.
1 minute, counsel.
Your Honor, I am struck by one phrase. And the one phrase I'm struck by is the good old days. I know exactly what was meant by that. I don't think anyone wants to go back to the good old days. I think we want to move forward in this country. I think we want to move forward in this county. There are a lot of people whose rights have been abridged by the good old days. And this inquest process is our best chance at moving forward and getting some answers to these questions. And I think that the statute is actually really great and really clear and gives us that mechanism to do that. And so we're asking the court to grant our writ, and we're asking the court to hold that criminal means cannot be categorically excluded by the executive. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Parker. Mr. Guilmette, you have about 8 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start by taking a couple minutes to address Mr. Estes' false claim that the inquest reform process was biased or, as he stated in his brief, corrupt. This claim is simply an effort to distract from the legal weaknesses in law enforcement's own arguments. In 2018, I represent the Public Defender Association as part of a coalition of 17 community organizations that advocated for reforms to this county's inquest process. This coalition included well-respected groups, such as the Seattle Community Police Commission, the Lauren Miller Bar Association, and the Latina Bar Association of Washington. The coalition met with the executive's office to discuss inquest reforms, and we shared recommendations created in coalition. This is called community engagement, and it's what democracy looks like. Law enforcement was involved in these meetings and communication. And frankly, that was remarkable. Families with loved ones killed by the police faced their trauma head on and sat down across the table from the very departments that killed their loved ones, and they tried to achieve compromise. So the claim that there was backroom dealing or corruption is false, and Mr. Estes knows this. His client, the City of Kent, was part of these discussions. So too was the King County Police Chiefs and Sheriff's Association. The inquest rules they claim I wrote were a proposal from our coalition. When it was sent to the executive's office, Ken Thomas, the former Kent police chief, was CC'd on that very email. So too was the Bothell police chief. So too was Chief Scrimshire, the Lodge 27 president of the Fraternal Order of Police and current Algona police chief. Here's how Chief Scrimshire described the reform process that Mr. Estes has labeled as corrupt. The new executive order on inquest is another example of what can happen when law enforcement and communities work together. Fraternal Order of Police appreciates the efforts made by all parties to come to the table to reform this process in King County. Mr. Estes' claims are false, and I hope we can instead focus on the law. And when we look at the law, the finalists' arguments have clear support. The other party's arguments that an inquest cannot make a criminal means assessment are clearly contradicted by case law. There are four cases that each make it absolutely clear that RCW 3624 involves a criminal means assessment. First, we have In re Boston, a Division I case from 2002, focused on the proper operation of King County's inquest process. The court wrote that the inquest, and I quote, supplied the executive with the jury's opinion as to the cause of death and criminal responsibility of those involved. Second, there is Carrick versus Locke, a 1994 Washington Supreme Court case, again focused on King County's inquest process. The court wrote, and again I quote, if the jury finds murder or manslaughter committed, the coroner must issue an arrest warrant for the person's not in custody. As explained in the Lyles reply brief, recent changes to RCW 3624-100 have replaced the coroner's duty to issue an arrest warrant with the duty to deliver the findings to the prosecuting attorney. However, 3624070, the criminal means statute of relevance to the family's writs, has remained unchanged, and thus so too has the jury's responsibility to make a criminal means assessment. Third, we have State versus Jefferson, a 1971 Washington Supreme Court case. In Jefferson, the court listed inquest proceedings as one of four procedures for commencing criminal charges against a defendant. Fourth, we have Reynolds versus Lewis County, 2015 opinion by the Western District of Washington affirmed by the Ninth Circuit that held that, and I quote, in Washington, an inquest proceeding is one of four established, recognized, and legally permissible methods for determining the existence of probable cause. These cases provide all the clarity needed. RCW 3624 requires a criminal liability determination. Policy and training are also properly within the inquest scope, and that's because in Carrick, the Washington Supreme Court specifically upheld the executive's power to create requirements and responsibilities beyond those outlined in 3624. The court wrote, and again I quote, in other cases, the district court judge is given responsibilities beyond those outlined in RCW Chapter 3624. But these extra duties do not contravene or render nugatory the duties outlined in that chapter. Clearly, when the statute and the executive order contain different but not conflicting requirements, the person conducting the inquest must comply with both requirements. Even entertaining for the sake of argument that the executive is strictly limited to the text of RCW 3624, policy and training are circumstances of the death. As a result, they are included within the inquest scope as outlined by RCW 3624-040, which requires the jurors to inquire into these circumstances of the death. A circumstance is a fact or condition connected with or relevant to an event or action.
Less than a minute, Mr. Gilmatt.
Clearly, law enforcement policy and training are connected with and relevant to officers' actions. For example, if an officer used a banned chokehold after being trained that such a chokehold could result in death, it would clearly be relevant to that officer's actions and properly considered within the scope of the inquest. As a result, there is no doubt that policy and training can and should be included within the scope of the inquest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmatt. Mr. Estes, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good old days only being when you weren't fired 8 hours after an incident based on a television report and in violation of your due process rights. We need some changes, but we're moving too drastically here against law enforcement. Appearance of fairness doctrine, it was actually litigated in Carrick, and it, the quote is, fairness concerns dictate that he, the executive assigned the inquest, ask to someone outside of his immediate authority, such as a district judge. That's not dicta. That's saying this is lawful because what the other way would be unlawful. That's very clear. And I'll rest on the briefing as far as Peterson. Peterson, in a footnote, refers to Carrick as the appearance of fairness not applying to an inquest. It's not what Carrick held, so it wouldn't be citing to that or that proposition. And even if it did, the Supreme Court doesn't overrule itself in a footnote with no analysis. And as I indicated, the executive and interveners have a very different view of the executive's authority. Ms. Kanner eloquently spoke about the charter provision in 300. However, again, she completely skips over the Constitution, which provides the executive no authority unless it flows through the legislature. So that's the big difference there. The charter does not overrule the Constitution. The executive has no authority unless the consul gives it to him, and he has not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Estes. Mr. Berrio, you have about 7 minutes shy.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to address three issues. First is the issue of standing, and I want to read a quote that is at the beginning of the executive's briefing with respect to standing, and it reads, quote, an individual has standing to bring an action or mandamus, therefore considered to be beneficially interested if he has an interest in the action beyond that shared in common with other citizens. End quote. And that's from Retired Public Employees Council of Washington versus Charles. This issue was addressed by the appellate court in Miranda v. Sims. That's a case in where the family argued that it was entitled to counsel. Well, the Court of Appeals determined that the family was not, but specifically made a distinction between family and involved officers. And this is what the court said. Here, the family's participation and interest in the proceedings is fundamentally different from that of the participants whose representation the county has paid for with public funds. The county agents and employees involved in the inquest may have had important knowledge of Guy's death and may be civilly or criminally liable. There, the Miranda quote was specifically acknowledging those interests unique to law enforcement officers, that beneficial interest that gives them standing in this case. I would also point out this argument that because the findings are not binding on anyone, there's no standing. While the findings may not be binding, the information that forms the foundation of those findings is binding. That information is consistently used in subsequent civil litigation, and the information therein is used to make specific charging decisions. So certainly these officers have standing and do have a vested beneficial interest. Address this issue about the right to remain silent. So counsel for the executive, Ms. Tanner, indicated that this is akin to a law enforcement investigation. Well, if it's akin to a law enforcement investigation, these officers, no different than any other person being investigated, have a right to remain silent. And the fact this investigation just happens to be occurring in a courtroom does not change that right. That right still exists. And whether or not the executive has the subpoena authority, they are still entitled to assert that right. Lastly, I want to address the pre-inquest discovery and this argument that RCW 36-24-200 allows pre-inquest discovery. And I want to take the sentence from the House bill for this statute. And what it says is, this will help coroners and medical examiners get more accurate information during a death investigation. This provision could avoid the need for inquests in some circumstances. The legislature here was looking at a death investigation and using pre-inquest discovery to avoid an inquest. They weren't suggesting that this statute allows inquest discovery. It's very specific from the House bill and from the language, as well as the language from BNSF, that pre-inquest discovery is not permitted. In fact, from the Supreme Court in BNSF. Moreover, RCW 36-24-020 does not allow pre-inquest inspection of the evidence, and for good reason. And I will point out, RCW statute 0.200 was in response to that, and they allowed for subpoenas of documentation. But importantly, they cite to 36-24-050, which says the coroner must summon and examine as witnesses every person in his or her opinion or that of any of the jury has any knowledge of the facts. This strong language shows that the coroner who convenes an inquest has no need to see the evidence in advance because he or she does not have the discretion to view a piece of evidence or hear a particular witness statement and decide not to present to the jury. That provision also applies to counsel that want to issue subpoenas, that want to get information. If this is a public viewing of the facts and the evidence, then the information that needs to come out happens in front of that jury, in the inquest proceeding, in the public. Nothing in the statute allows the parties to conduct all this pre-inquest discovery and then put their own twist and take on what information actually ends up in front of the jury. The idea behind the inquest is to present all of it at that point in time. And everyone who's involved has that opportunity. They can ask those questions. As I noted in my earlier argument, family for the counsel can ask questions. Counsel for the officers can question. And in fact, even the jury can ask questions. And allowing pre-inquest discovery allows the parties to manipulate that evidence and present it in a way that may ultimately not allow all of the facts and circumstances to come out in front of the jury, which defeats the purposes of the inquest. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Cobb?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to address some points very particularly from each of the presentations. The county suggests in their discussion of issue of standing, because no subpoenas have currently been issued, there is no standing on the part of the officers in particular to challenge the statute itself allowing for subpoenas. What the county is suggesting is a situation where in each and every inquest that arises, each time a subpoena is issued that is believed to be inappropriate, which would occur in these new circumstances in almost every case, the county suggests that each of those inquests should be interrupted by additional legal challenges, and that just doesn't make any sense. For this question is a fundamental question of constitutional significance, Your Honor, and it should be decided up front whether or not and to what extent a court has subpoena authority over an officer. As to the Fifth Amendment issue, the system as currently established, the changes in the process have brought about the situation that makes the Fifth Amendment, that implicates the Fifth Amendment specifically. And I want to read from a portion of our brief. Again, I'm citing to the same case that Mr. Burial was citing to, Miranda v. Sims. And in Miranda, discussing the implication of criminal liability for an officer, Miranda cited the seminal federal precedent acknowledging the unique situation officers occupy, an internal citation, simply stated, officers are the only participants in the inquest that bear the potential risk of prosecution as a result of the inquiry. Law enforcement officers do not forfeit their constitutional rights by pinning on the badge to protect and serve. Public employees, like all others, are entitled to the benefit of the Constitution, including the privilege against self-incrimination. The availability, and this is the important part, the availability of the Fifth Amendment privilege does not turn upon the type of proceeding in which protection is invoked, but rather upon the nature of the statement or admission and the exposure or penalty which it invites. And that's State v. Post, Your Honor. Under these circumstances, the officers are being expected to appear in court to give testimony which may implicate them, and particularly under the changes that are being proposed by the families, directly implicating them in what the families say the jury should determine, which is whether or not these officers are criminally liable. And that holding, that suggestion is just completely differing from what the Supreme Court has already held over and over and over, despite the four cases that have been cited by Mr. Gumet, that inquests are not culpability-finding proceedings. So while we would agree that under the previous inquest process, they would have a better argument against Fifth Amendment incrimination, if this process moves forward as currently proposed, Your Honor, they absolutely have a very real and significant chance of being affected by the outcome of these proceedings. Ms. Parker misinterpreted, I believe, the comments regarding a jury making these determinations. At least for me in particular, my comments were not directed to the sophistication of a jury or being able to make these determinations. This is a fact-finding hearing. It's not a culpability-finding proceeding. And in these cases, any time that you invoke a jury having to determine a legal question, having to contemplate the law, then we're outside of the scope of this intended process in the first place. So we're saying that these juries in these circumstances cannot be tasked with understanding the law behind the use of force. They are being tasked with determining what the facts were of what occurred. The legal determinations are for another person, another proceeding, and another day. As to the issue of the appointment of the county executive's appointment of administrators, I think that the Carrick case, the direct quote, is an inquest conducted by an officer under the direct control of the county executive could not provide the necessary assurances of impartiality the public expects from an inquest. And that's Eric at 143. I don't know how that could be read in any other way than what it does, is that the current procedure and the way that it's set up is outside of the authority of the executive. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Cobb. Mr. Miller?
If I have any remaining time, I'd like to defer it to Mr. Miller, please.
Sure. Go ahead, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to pick up first on Mr. Filer's comment about the authority in 3624.050, which speaks to summoning and examining witness. And one of the key words that he used in there were knowledge of the facts. And this goes back to the expert witness issue. Certainly, the investigatory experts, the ballistics experts, the medical examiner, they are people with knowledge of the facts. Outside experts are not, and that is the distinction that we drew in our briefing and that I drew earlier in my comments. So by his own acknowledgement, these witnesses must have factual knowledge, and outside experts inherently do not, they were not involved in the incident, they weren't involved in the investigation, they have no factual knowledge, they have opinions. And that is where we transgress from factual procedure to a fault-finding procedure or adversarial procedure. Secondly, with respect to Mr. Gilmay's discussion about policy and training, absolutely, policy and training are relevant in inquest proceedings. Officers often testify that the reason they took the actions they took were because that was how they were trained. That was the policy they were acting under. We're not seeking to limit that sort of testimony. What we are seeking to limit is what the executive has created as an unfair structure where the chief of police is brought in to testify the policy and training and then not permitted to give any opinion testimony with respect to whether the officer's conduct was in compliance with that policy and training, but instead leaves that to the jury and even arguably under the inquest orders that have predated these petitions up to outside experts like police practices experts. So a police practices expert who has no knowledge of that agency's policies and training can come in and give opinion testimony as to whether an officer was or was not in compliance with training. But the chief of the own department that gave the policy or that implemented the policies and gave the training can't give that same testimony. And that is fundamentally unfair. And that also, as we discussed before, puts to the jury an opinion question, not a factual question. That's not proper under 3624.040, which only speaks in terms of facts and circumstances of the death. With respect to the standing issue, I'd just point out, I fall back to our briefing and to Mr. Estes and Ms. Cobb's and Mr. Berrio's arguments, but also standing speaks in terms of economic harm, and there is no doubt that the cities and entities that are the intervener petitioners here stand to suffer economic harm. Hours of records reproduction, hours of time for overtime for testifying in the proceedings. We pointed this out in our briefing. So they'll be preparing. They'll be hiring counsel. We are not pro bono counsel that get hired to represent agencies and officers in these matters. So there is economic harm that will be experienced aside from the contemplated constitutional violations of the officer's right against self-incrimination and a right to counsel that all the parties have been discussing. So with that, I don't think I have anything further, Your Honor. I just request that you grant our petition. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Filer?
A few points briefly. First, with regard to the question of whether the executive can appoint someone.
You froze. We lost you, Mr. Filer.
Preside over these hearings?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you still there?
Yeah, you froze for about a second. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. On this question of whether the executive can appoint executive officers to preside over the hearings, I simply note that in counties that have elected coroners, the coroners often conduct these inquest proceedings themselves by delegating the job of overseeing these proceedings to their deputy coroners. And the appointment here of highly qualified inquest administrators to do that by the executive under his authority as the coroner is no different than the way it is conducted in these other counties, and it is no less fair and is certainly appropriate. So that's the first point. The second point is on this question of whether the inquest administrators have the ability to require witnesses to show up for pre-hearing depositions or to produce documents. And I think all you really need to do is to take a look at Section 200 that was added by the legislature to the coroner's statute in an immediate reaction to BNSF versus Clark. And I will simply add that there are some very practical reasons for why you want the administrator or the coroner to be able to do that, not the least of which is to figure out whether there is evidence in there that informs his opinion about whether someone has knowledge of the facts or not. And on top of that, you want to make sure that that evidence, if it is at risk of disappearing, is properly preserved so that it can be presented to the inquest jury at the appropriate time. Then the third point, and this will be my last substantive point, on experts, there's no question that the executive order authorizes the inquest administrators to consider whether to admit expert testimony. The examples that are given in the executive order are not exhaustive. They are samplers only. And it is clear that if the administrator makes a decision that expert testimony is directly related to the issues of the facts and circumstances of the death, that evidence ought to come in. But it's also clear that that evidence is not going to come in unless the party that is the proponent of that evidence makes that kind of foundational showing in advance and not just willy-nilly, as may be suggested here. My final point is this. Several counsel have raised the question of whether these proceedings are going to go forward, either under this guise or otherwise. And I'll go all the way back to where I started. The administrators urged this court to make a ruling and craft a remedy to allow these proceedings to go forward just as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Filer. Final word, Ms. Kanner.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity to go last. I want to first respond to what Mr. Estes said about the state constitution, because he implies that I'm ignoring the state constitution. I think the problem with that argument is that he fails to acknowledge the home rule section of the state constitution, Article 11, Section 4, Amendment 21, which authorizes the freeholders, meaning the county legislature, to propose a charter to the people and then for the people to ratify that charter and to adopt it. That's the same process for the amendments to the charter. So the legislature has spoken and the people have spoken, and they've given the power of the coroner to the executive. I want to then turn to the criminal means issue that I didn't get a chance to address earlier. And I would submit to the court that RCW 3624070 means just this. The jury needs to be asked, one, was the person killed by another? And two, if so, who, if known? The cases that are cited by Mr. Gilmet that seem to suggest otherwise, that a criminal means inquiry, and it is suggested by Ms. Parker, is a mandatory part of the statute, all rely on the arrest warrant section of the coroner statute, which has since been repealed. And so those cases are not good law on that point. Rather, the coroner statute has an or, essentially not mandating any type of criminal means inquiry, and rather just mandating an inquiry as to whether or not the person was killed by another, and if so, essentially the whodunit question. The last thing I want to address is a point brought up by Mr. Miller on this idea of economic harm, that they will have to suffer legal process, there's discovery, they'll have to hire attorneys. Their decision to hire attorneys to represent them is their own decision. That is not a making of the inquest. If they choose to have counsel represent them, they can, and most of them, it's their municipalities who actually pay for counsel. The issue on subpoenas, Trump versus Vance, which is the U.S. Supreme Court decision that was just issued about a week and a half ago, speaks to the fact that all citizens have to answer legal process via subpoena. That is our duty as citizens. Now, if you are subpoenaed to give information via testimony or subpoenaed to keep them, you also have the ability to contest that subpoena, as is demonstrated by the remand of Trump versus Vance, for an inquiry in the trial court to determine whether or not the subpoena is appropriate. And the last thing I want to address, Your Honor, is the fact that all these parties have come to court and asked for judicial intervention of what is an executive branch function. And all of these parties can lobby for changes to the policy through the political process. They can join committees. The policy has a revision process built in that it's going to be reviewed every year. They can try to make the policy better. They can try to convince the executive to do something differently. They can put statements in the media, as many of them have, in order to try and influence those policy decisions. But the courtroom, is not the forum for policymaking. The forum for policymaking is the political process. And that's not what the interveners here and the petitioners here are asking you to do. They're asking for judicial intervention and a violation of separation of powers to have the judiciary dictate to the executive within its own powers. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you all. What I would like by the close of next week, a week from today, I would like proposed orders from all nine parties. As I said last Friday at our CR16 conference, I will try to issue a written opinion within approximately 30 days. So it'll either come out August 14th or Monday, August 17th. I realize that this is a highly controversial case. We had at one point today over 140 participants. I applaud each and every one of the people who Zoomed in. I really appreciate the professionalism with which people attended this hearing during this unprecedented time of a pandemic. We are down to about 107 people now. Some people have Zoomed in and out. I've seen some people tune out and then tune back in. We are concluded here today. It's 12:16 in about 33 seconds. This has been recorded through the regular court recording system. If anybody wants to seek a copy of it, they may do so through the clerk's office in the ordinary course of our practice for providing records of lower court hearings. My anticipation is that I will issue the opinion to the parties and potentially the press and issue it on the court's website, the general court's website, for anybody to view. The record is closed. We don't need any more legal briefing. As I believe Ms. Parker pointed out correctly, there I have a mountain of briefing. Yeah, there is a mountain out here on the bench, and there's probably more back in my office of independent research. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for their professionalism and all the participants who came in and were part of the process. And I just want to make a note, we would not have been able to conduct this in my courtroom with 140 people. So if anything, Zoom allowed for a far broader audience than would ordinarily be available for public access to the courts. So everybody stay safe, wear your masks, wash your hands, and I'll issue an opinion in approximately 30 days. Thank you. I'm going to end the meeting now.